When Jesus refers to the law and the prophets, that was kind of an abbreviated form of saying that the whole of the Jewish tradition, that's everything. And so, as a good Jew, he was aware that the summation of the Jewish law is love. Not the law, but the Jewish life, because as we know, you can't legislate law, and the Jews knew that. So I'd like to talk to a little bit briefly today, because it's so cold, about love. I doubt that there are many words in the English language as debased, or maybe I should better say as elastic, as the word love. It covers the most extraordinarily wide variety of phenomena. Contradictory phenomena, even. So it's really important that we understand, as it comes from the scriptures and Jesus, what we're talking about. So I made a little inventory of what love means for me as a way of kind of juxtaposing that with something different. First of all, it's a cure for loneliness. I mean, that's sort of self-evident. I need company. I can't stand being by myself. Solitude stinks most of the time. So there's that. And then there's a sense that the world is often enough a really inimical place, loveless place. And so if I can kind of get somebody else to form a small circle with me, then I can kind of defend myself against a heartless and a ruthless world. And so love is a mutual defense pact. It can work that way, too. Love answers my need to be needed. I need somebody to need me. And so love can look like that, you know. And then it used to be said, although I'm not so sure it's ever true, that two can live as cheaply as one. Love can constitute a kind of economic unit. I mean, smart money says, you know, we don't have two rents to pay, we just pay one. So let's get married. And then, much more subtle, and as I said, this is self-inventory. There's this extraordinary kind of love which says that I just want to pour myself out on behalf of this other person. As an adolescent, this was a very strong thing in me until I grew up a little bit and saw what was the dynamic of that impulse, which was that I felt that I was so worthless that anybody looked better than me, and therefore you get kind of quality by just giving yourself, throwing yourself, wholesale. I would have died. I truly would have died for some of the people I went to school with, because they were so much better than I, and, you know, that at least would give me some sort of meager quality. What all of those things have in common is that I am the ultimate object of love. That I am the ultimate object of all of those forms of love. And so I used to say that, well, the problem is, I remember vividly in class writing on the board, I said, when most people say, I love you, they really mean, I need you. And that, I think, covers an awful lot of cases. Maybe most cases. But then thinking more about it, there's a different set of needs Because I think that we human beings are essentially needy creatures. And as a footnote to that, I would even make the somewhat audacious claim that none of us deserves to be loved. But to go on, there are needs and there are needs. Let me give you the three classic needs that Plato and the Greeks talked about, which I think helped me, at least, to get beyond this kind of meager, self-engrossed disguise form. It's not a disguised form of love. It is a sort of infantile form of love. What do I need? I need truth. We live in a highly pragmatic world. You know? You have to make all kinds of causal connections. But I think at our best, we need truth. And that's a very interesting thing, because I can't make a demand on truth. Truth makes a claim on me. You see? And yet I know that without truth, I cannot live a human life. Without truth, even if it's the truth of Freud or the truth of Marx, that God is wish fulfillment, or God is a great panacea and anodyne for a too painful human existence. I need truth. And is that need that humanizes me? I need beauty. And beauty, I can't make any claims on either. Beauty doesn't make demands on me, it's just there, and I respond to it. And my very response to it, I get bigger. Notice, this is not answering to some kind of hole in me, some kind of at least superficial hole. And then, of course, the last of this triad is that I need goodness. I really do. Despite the cynicism, the disappointments, the frustrations, I need goodness. I really do. I need somehow in my life to be assured that the brutality, the indifference of so much of what goes for human existence, so much phoniness, so much disguised love, is not ultimate. So, I think this opens the way to looking at love the way the Bible and Jesus dealt with it, that somehow to love means not to look at the world through the filters of my own kind of lowercase needs, if you will. Because when I do that, of course, I distort the other. The other never really emerges into my purview except as it's diminished by these, my little bitty appetites to be needed, to make money, to have power, all this stuff. So that opens up a whole different set of problems. How, in God's name, and does anybody get to that point? And that's where I think we come to very much the heart of what Jesus was about and the Bible was about. It is a mystery. On all kinds of grounds, it's a mystery. Love, if love means me concentrating in a non-neurotic way on the other, and I put it to you, that is, in the strictest sense of the word, a mystery. It's mysterious as to what that would be like, because there are very few instances in my existence where I can point to anything that's even remotely like that. It's mysterious in that I have not a clue as to how I get from being the Trojak of today to the Trojak who loves in that way. Trojak who does not make a Trojak-sized world, you know, which is pretty little and pretty meager and jejune and in the long run ugly as well. And that's what we say God is all about. God who somehow sees us as we are and yet sees us as transformable. As the first letter of John says, God is love, and whoever lives in love lives in God. And that's what we're talking about, God who lets the world be. This is extraordinarily obvious. It's extraordinarily important, I think. Not only is it central to the biblical stuff and the tradition at its best, but it's very helpful, I think, for me to make assessments of myself. But it's also important because it enables me to make an assessment of the church as well. And let me go back to this pedophile thing, because this is still rumbling through. You know, the Vatican has established that the U.S. norms are not adequate, and as I said last week, I think that's true, but then they appointed a panel of four bishops, four of the most conservative people in the American hierarchy. And it's no secret, not going to be any surprise, as to what they're going to end up saying. You know? They're going to be little ventriloquist dummies in the hands of Cardinal Ratzinger, the Pope. What I'm getting at is this. The church exists in dogma, in liturgy, in creed, code, and cult, you know, the big three C's, to make the mystery of, to protect the mystery of God, the mystery of love. And that's its only reason for existence. And that provides the criteria whereby we can judge the adequacy of this statement, or this document, or this ceremony, or this way of behaving, or this political structure, or whatever. Yeah. Granted, of course, that we are all sinners. But that's supposed to be part of our self-presentation, too. And that's why this, and even to find out how we are sinners is done only in light of this attempted description of what love is about. I am a sinner to the extent that I fail, that extraordinary and impossible criterion of what love is about. So, that's where we are, on the edge of mystery. That's what the liturgy is about. This is my life for you. This is my flesh, this is my blood, this is everything I am. This is for you. No strings. So, as sinners, as we started out to Mass, we come to admit to ourselves a little more, I hope after today, to each other, to God, where we're not, but where we want to be.